is Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM and streaming live with a live stream at freakradio.org. Click on the red oval. This is the Mideast Migraine Show for Monday, January 13. In the year of the Common Era, 2014. 1-13-14. Alrighty, get that out of the way. Move this sucker down into the corner. Hi, my name is Ren, and this is the Mideast Migraine Show, coming to you every Monday for almost 2 hours, 3 in the afternoon. I, Ren, am the local, friendly Palestinian-American who is taking advantage of Free Radio Santa Cruz's gracious offer to submit my take on the situation over in Israel and Palestine, what's really happening over there, and what exactly that all has to do with you. The thing is, as many of you know, as many of you have heard, okay, just trying to prevent a little feedback there, former Prime Minister of Israel, Ariel Sharon, who has been in a comatose state for 8 years, finally passed away 2 days ago, Saturday, the 11th of January. About a week ago, in fact, exactly 1 week before Sharon's demise, I read a pre-obituary by an American Jew named Miko Peled, who's the son of an Israeli war hero, a general, in fact, in the 1967 sneak attack by Israel on Egypt and their subsequent conquest of land taken from Syria and Jordan. But Miko's father, Mati Peled, got to a point where he denounced a warlike frame of mind in dealing with the Palestinian Arabs and became an activist for peace. That's Miko's father, Mati Peled. Miko followed in his father's footsteps, certainly in regard to Mati's peace activism. And so, in anticipation of Mr. Sharon's death, because it was noted about a week before his actual demise that Sharon is his kidneys are failing while he lies in a coma since 2006. Had a series of strokes, I believe, during his prime ministership, which led to someone else taking over, of course. Not for the better. Well, in a sense, just about anyone would have been better than Prime Minister Sharon. Sharon was a very, very warlike individual. So, in anticipation of Sharon's demise, Miko wrote this little sort of pre-obituary, which I read when it came out on January 4th. And upon Ariel's death, I read it again 2 days ago, Saturday, the day that Sharon officially was pronounced deceased. I got one or two other pieces about Ariel Sharon, what the guy was really about, which when you hear this, really puts into focus the almost really totally inept and incomplete descriptions that major American media, what I like to call big box media, at least the electronic forms of TV and radio, have put him in that kind of light. This piece by Mikko Pellet calls into question the inadequacy of mainstream media's treatment of the man. This is entitled, and I read it for the third time, once the first time 7 days before his death and then upon his death. Now 2 days later, dated January 14th, final words on Sharon by Mikko Pellet. I never understood how people could rejoice at the news of a person's death. I happened to be in the United Kingdom when Margaret Thatcher died, so I witnessed the celebrations. The expressions of joy as the news of the Iron Lady's death spread around the country shocked me at first, as people were actually throwing parties to celebrate her death. As I visited different parts of the country, particularly Wales and Ireland, it occurred to me that when Ariel Sharon dies, we may see similar outbursts of joy taking place. And mind you again, these are the words of Mr. Mikko Pellet, American Jew. Sharon has been in a coma since January 2006 when he suffered several brain hemorrhages. That's what it was, brain hemorrhages, several. That left him in a vegetative state. But now there is news that his kidneys are failing and concerns are expressed in Israel that there is a chance he will die soon. One can imagine the long eulogies we will have to endure once he is laid to rest. A hero, a great leader, a military genius. All of this will be said and more. The press will recount every military achievement, every battle he won, every enemy, both military and political, that he defeated. His resolve as Israel's leader will be heralded, and we will be told he will be remembered for giving his all to his country. In my book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, I mentioned Sharon several times in his capacity as a military man who is cruel, brilliant, and reckless, then as defense minister and finally as prime minister. But it is important to set the record straight about this man before the nauseating outpour of condolences replete with hypocrisy and lies that are sure to follow his death. Ariel Sharon was an ambitious man. He was brutal, greedy, uncompromising, and dishonest. He possessed an insatiable appetite for power, glory, and fortune. His tendencies as a cold-blooded, merciless killer were evident from early on in his career when he commanded the Israeli Army's Unit 101 in the 1950s. Unit 101 was an infamous commando brigade with special license to kill and terrorize Palestinians. It operated mostly in Gaza, but also in other parts of the country and beyond. Unit 101 was so brutal in its practices and claimed so many innocent lives that even by Israeli standards, it was thought to have gone too far and the unit was eventually disbanded. Sharon went on to be promoted to other commands in the Israeli army, earning a name for himself as a promising commander, and all were expecting that he would one day be the Israeli army's top commander or chief of staff. But this was one job he never got. He did better. Sharon entered politics and was nominated to be defense minister under Prime Minister Menachem Begin. In that capacity, he led Israel's catastrophic invasion of Lebanon in 1982. This invasion left countless Lebanese and Palestinians dead, wounded, and displaced. Sharon was also behind the massacres that took place in September of 1982 in the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps near Beirut. And here, once again, even by Israeli standards, Sharon had gone too far and was removed from office. Though Sharon was reprimanded for his role in the Sabra and Shatila massacre and was prevented from serving as prime minister, his political career continued nevertheless, and his sphere of influence grew. As Minister of Housing and Development, he contributed more than any other to the racist, anti-Palestinian policies and the corruption within the ministry. It is claimed that during his tenure, the ministry's budget was without limits, exceeding Israel's entire defense budget. He used his full weight to achieve the colonization and displacement of Palestinians from what used to be the West Bank. Surely the most absurd thing ever said about Sharon is that he was a man of peace, that he, quote, left Gaza, and that he, quote, gave Gaza back to the Palestinians. That he did it for peace, and in return all Israel received were rockets fired from Gaza. The Israeli disengagement from Gaza was a cynical, unilateral move. It allowed Sharon to get the Israeli settlers in Gaza out of his way, close Gaza like a prison, and score a few political points with the U.S. administration. It was a cruel move that allowed him to further suffocate the people of Gaza. People that he was determined to destroy from early on in his violent career. But the proud Palestinians would not surrender and served as a constant reminder of the blood with which his hands are stained. One could go on and on about Sharon and his crimes. As he lay dying, perhaps within days or minutes of his final breath, we must all remember his victims, the countless dead, wounded, and displaced, and remind the world that this man was not a hero, but a criminal. As I write these words, Ariel Sharon is still alive, if one can call it that, and in many ways the state in which he lives now could be the hell he so richly deserves. End of pre-obituary, of course, written 7 days before the official announcement of the death of Ariel Sharon. This piece appears on Miko Peled's personal blog, Tear Down the Wall. Details about purchasing his book, The General's Son. The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, of course, appear on that blog site. Many, many responses. 43 as of January 4th, some 10 days ago or so, 9 days ago, 43 responses to Final Words on Sharon by Miko Peled. I'll read a few. GWPJ says, same day it came out, thank you, Miko, for writing and sharing this. Last evening, my wife, Eiko, and I watched a documentary on Israel and Gaza by Japanese journalist Akira Ikegami that showed so many of the things you write about and know. Powerful, disturbing, and I wish it could be shown on American TV. Ariel Sharon was a brute. He has lived his last years in a living hell, which sounds like it is ending. It will be interesting to see how many people celebrate his death. Another reader writes, wow, heavy, thanks for sharing. Another writer says, Dr. Matilda M. Gianferrara, thanks, Miko, I posted it on my Facebook page. Probably they'll censor it. Have a good year with your family. Pat says, thanks for posting, Miko. If only the world understood this man better. Yes, the condolences to be expressed by the leaders of the U.S. and the fawning of the entire Congress will truly be nauseating. Ed Kay says, "No way in the world people with common sense can be stupid. If someone inside himself knows that this man is a criminal who committed war crimes and deserved punishment, but he is defending him as a hero, I call that dishonesty. But if you firmly believe..." I don't understand this guy either. Let me finish this paragraph at least. "But if you firmly believe that he is a hero and deserves the respect inside and out, then this is what I call ignorance, lacking knowledge of facts, our human heart. Let us not fool ourselves. This man will go in the history of the world as a criminal as ever, with more crimes on the horizon by people that he left behind him to protect and continue a racist and apartheid state. Read ex-President Carter book. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." One more. I'll just read this quick one by Frank Hayes, January 4th. "I do not practice hatred. For this would mirror this monster. But I will reserve a deep contempt for this Nat Zionist war criminal, Ariel Sharon. I am sure there is no afterlife, but if a hell were to exist, he would meet his soul brothers, Adolf, Heinrich, Hermann, Joseph, and so many more. There in hell." Of course, he would be referring to Adolf Hitler, Heinrich Himmler, Hermann Goebbels, I believe, who was on Hitler's staff, and Joseph Mengele, the infamous medical doctor, eugenist on Hitler's team. Okay, all righty. Let's get to the other ones. The other pieces about Ariel Sharon. Those who have been listening to my shows recently know that I have a strong attachment to and respect for Mr. Max Blumenthal, another American Jew, born and raised in the United States on the East Coast, Boston, Massachusetts, I believe. Max Blumenthal wrote a book last year entitled Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, and I have just completed part two on my Saturday show, the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines. I will begin part three this coming Saturday. Until then, we have, and this was written in The Nation, or at least on The Nation magazine's website, this article by Max Blumenthal, same author, "How Ariel Sharon Shaped Israel's Destiny." Max Blumenthal, January 11. "A central player in Israeli affairs since the state's inception, Ariel Sharon molded history according to his own stark vision. He won consent for his plans through ruthlessness and guile, and resorted to force when he could not find any. An accused war criminal who presided over the killing of thousands of civilians, his foes referred to him as the bulldozer. To those who revered him as a strong-armed protector and patron saint of the settlements, he was, quote, the King of Israel. In a life acted out in three parts, Sharon destroyed entire cities, wasted countless lives, and sabotaged careers to shape the reality on the ground. The first act of Sharon's career began after the 1948 war that established Israel at the expense of 750,000 Palestinians who were driven away in a campaign of mass expulsion. Badly wounded in the Battle of Latrun, where the Israeli army suffered a bitter defeat at the hands of the Royal Jordanian Army, Sharon momentarily retired from army life. He looked back in anger at the failure to take Latrun, a strategic swath of land containing three Palestinian towns seemingly obstructing the new Jewish state's demographic continuity. Spineless politicians and feckless commanders had tied the hands of Israel's troops, he claimed, leaving the Jewish state exposed from within. Sharon yearned to finish 1948, to complete the expulsion, project he viewed as deficient. In 1953, Sharon was plucked out of retirement by Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion and appointed the head of a secret commando unit tasked with carrying out brutal acts of reprisal and sabotage. Following a lethal Palestinian assault on an Israeli kibbutz, Sharon led his men into the West Bank town of Kibka with orders from Ben-Gurion's Central Command to, and I quote, carry out destruction and cause maximum damage. By the time they were done, 69 civilians, mostly Palestinian women and children, lay dead. In the years after that scandal, Sharon carried out bloody raids on Egyptian and Syrian territory that inflamed relations with Israel's neighbors and led them to seek urgent military assistance from the Soviet Union. In the 1956 Sinai campaign, Sharon was accused by one of his commanders, Ari Biro, of overseeing the massacre of 49 Egyptian quarry workers who had been taken prisoner and had no role in the fighting. Incidentally, official censorship kept the details from the public for decades. In the 1967 Six-Day War, Sharon ran up the body count on encircled Egyptian tank units, converting unprecedented kill ratios into national fame. With the Gaza Strip now under Israeli control, Sharon orchestrated the razing of Palestinian citrus orchards to make way for Jewish colonization. And, okay, just checking out some stuff here. Okay. To make way for Jewish colonization. During the 1973 war, Sharon waged his own parallel war for personal glory. Determined to be the first Israeli commander to cross the Suez Canal, he sent his soldiers rushing into the teeth of the Egyptian army without sufficient artillery or air support. Scores of his men died in the blind thrust while entire brigades were left exposed. But Sharon salvaged his quest for fame when his tank brigades encircled the Egyptian Third Army. After the battle, photos of the general standing proudly in the Egyptian desert, bandaged from a superficial wound and surrounded by soldiers, hailing him as the King of Israel, circulated in the Israeli and international media. The high-flying political career he had sought was now guaranteed. In short order, Sharon helped found the Likud Party, opening the second act of his storied career. Again, a reminder, I'm reading from an article that appears on thenation.com as of yesterday, entitled How Ariel Sharon Shaped Israel's Destiny. It was written by Max Blumenthal. Continuing with article. Though set on a rightward political trajectory, Sharon owed his fortunes to the icons of labor Zionism, the Zionist Labor Party. His original patron, Ben-Gurion, and the younger warrior politician Moshe Dayan constantly shuffled him up the ranks of the military hierarchy despite a clear pattern of scandalously insubordinate behavior. His first cabinet-level post was an abbreviated stint in the 1970s government of Yitzhak Rabin, the quintessential laborite, who imagined Sharon leading a reorganization of the army following the disaster of the 1973 war. But it was the Likud-led 1977 coalition of Menachem Begin that Sharon was finally able to translate his influence into history-altering policies. Appointed Minister of Agriculture, Sharon exploited his seemingly insignificant position to bring the messianic project of Greater Israel to fruition. With unbridled vigor, he expanded the settlement enterprise across the West Bank, boasting that he personally established 64 settlements during his first 4 years in government. He revealed his strategy in a private chat with Winston Churchill's grandson, and I quote, this is a statement from Ariel Sharon, quote, "We'll make a pastrami sandwich out of them. We'll insert a strip of Jewish settlements in between the Palestinians, and then another strip of Jewish settlements right across the West Bank, so that in 25 years' time, neither the United Nations nor the United States, nobody, will be able to tear it apart." End quote. Private chat with Winston Churchill's grandson, Winston III, by the way. Having established himself as the visionary behind the settlements, Sharon set his sights on the Ministry of Defense, actively intimidating Begin to fulfill his ambition. When Begin finally capitulated before Sharon's bullying, he declared only half-jokingly that Sharon might have staged a military coup if he hadn't been offered his desired sinecure. You got 10 years and you've got sinecures. I'm not sure how that translates into modern English. I think the two words are related. Continuing, Sharon entered the defense ministry consumed with dreams of an Israeli-friendly Christian puppet government in Beirut, the bulwark of a regional Israeli empire. Clamoring for an invasion of Lebanon, Sharon withheld his true intentions from everyone except perhaps Begin, claiming he merely aimed to drive the PLO, Palestine Liberation Organization, out of southern Lebanon, where it had staged periodic raids on Israeli territory. When Begin greenlighted Operation Peace for Galilee, for Israel's own Galilee territory, in June 1982, Sharon sent Israeli tanks... Please don't do that. Oh, God. Okay. Just lost my pager for just a moment. Begin the sentence again. When Begin greenlighted Operation Peace for Galilee in June 1982, Sharon sent Israeli tanks rumbling towards Beirut, the capital of Lebanon, without the approval of the rest of the cabinet, whom Sharon had deliberately deceived. Many of them were outraged, but it was too late to turn back. Against fierce Palestinian resistance, one of the Middle East's most vital and cosmopolitan cities was laid to ruin. Beirut, of course. Sharon's forces flattened West Beirut with indiscriminate shelling, leaving streets strewn with unburied corpses. With each passing day, disease and famine spread at epidemic levels. In August, the day after the Israeli cabinet accepted U.S. Special Envoy Philip Habib's proposal for the evacuation of the PLO, Sharon's forces bombarded Beirut for 7 hours straight, leaving 300 dead, most of them civilians. The Israeli sociologist Baruch Kimmerling wrote that the raid, quote, resembled the attack on Dresden by the Allies toward the end of World War II. Sharon even requested an additional paratrooper brigade to obliterate the PLO forces besieged in the city, earning a rare rebuke from Begin, who worried that his defense minister would completely destroy Habib's efforts to resolve the crisis. PLO forces withdrew from Lebanon, according to Habib's guidelines, but the worst was yet to come. Sharon had stymied a proposal for the introduction of multinational peacekeepers capable of preventing reprisals against the defenseless Palestinian refugees who had been left behind. Thus, the stage was set for the most heinous massacre of the war. Following the assassination of Bashir Gemayel, the military, who was, as I recall, the military president of Lebanon at the time, the Christian warlord who was supposed to serve as Sharon's hand-picked puppet, President Bashir Gemayel, Israeli forces helped usher Palestinian phalangist militias into the Palestinian camps of Sabra and Shatila, then surrounded by the Israeli military, providing them with intelligence and operational support. Sharon and many of his officers were well aware of the phalangists' intention to murder as many women and children as they could. Again, talking about Christians murdering and massacring overwhelmingly Islamic Arabs. Christians killing Muslims. After days of slaughter, as many as 2,000 civilians were dead, with countless others raped and brutalized. In February 1983, Israel's Kahan Commission found Sharon, quote, indirectly responsible for the massacre, urging his dismissal as defense minister. With the Israeli body count, piling up in Lebanon, city squares in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem were thronged with outraged mothers and a growing movement of service refuseniks. The anti-war demonstrations shook the confidence of the army's high command. At the prime minister's office, Sharon berated Begin and his ministers, warning them, if we adopt this Kahan report, all our ill-wishers and naysayers will think what happened in the camp was genocide, end quote. Calling the findings, quote, a mark of Cain on all of us for generations, Sharon adamantly refused to step down. During the meeting, a right-wing Jewish terrorist lobbed a live grenade into a crowd of anti-war protesters right outside the prime minister's office, killing the teacher and anti-war activist Emil Grunzweig. The incident was Sharon's coup de grace, prompting his resignation. Though he remained in government as a minister without portfolio, his dreams of serving as prime minister appeared to be dashed. Sharon's fear of prosecution did not end with his resignation. In July 2001, a Belgian court opened an inquiry into the Sabra and Shatila massacre when a group of survivors filed a complaint under the country's, quote, universal jurisdiction guidelines. Eli Hobeika, the phalangist commander directly responsible for the killings, was assassinated months later after informing Belgian politicians that he would testify against Sharon. Israel doesn't want witnesses against it in this historic case in Belgium, which will certainly convict Ariel Sharon, the Lebanese minister of displaced people Marwan Hamadeh remarked at the time, echoing widespread speculation about Sharon's involvement. In September 2003, with Belgian relations with Israel at an all-time low, the Belgian court threw out the case, citing Sharon's diplomatic immunity. By this time, Sharon had resuscitated his political career in dramatic fashion on September 28, 2000, following the collapse of peace negotiations between Israel and the Palestinian Authority at Camp David that summer. Sharon toured the Haram al-Sharif in Jerusalem, site of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock, accompanied by 1,000 armed police and security agents. It was a provocative stunt staged to inflame rising tensions in the occupied territories. As expected, the appearance sparked widespread Palestinian rioting the next day, which was met with a draconian Israeli crackdown. Israeli forces fired 1.3 million bullets. 1.3 million bullets at mostly unarmed demonstrators in October 2000 alone, fueling what became known as the Al-Aqsa Intifada. The following year, Sharon was elected Prime Minister of Israel, and Palestinian suicide bombings were battering the cafes and nightclubs of Tel Aviv and West Jerusalem, channeling the mood of Israel's, quote, peace camp, which had called for Sharon's ouster during the invasion of Lebanon. The liberal newspaper Haaretz demanded, quote, a war about the morning's coffee and croissant. The beleaguered peace camp was shocked at the intifada, but also cynically misled by Sharon's predecessor as Prime Minister, Ehud Barak, who declared after the collapse of the Camp David negotiations that there was, quote, no Palestinian partner, end quote, for peace. Sapped of confidence, they became quiescent while the mainstream united behind Sharon, their vengeful protector. With a free hand to deploy tanks and combat jets against Palestinian population centers, Sharon oversaw a campaign of carefully calculated brutality, culminating in 2002 in the comprehensive demolition of the Jenin refugee camp. Baruch Kimmerling termed Sharon's strategy politicide, a gradual but systematic attempt to cause Palestine's annihilation as an independent political and social entity, end quote. As in the beginning, Sharon's unspoken goal was to finish the war of 1948. While Israeli bulldozers trundled across Gaza and the West Bank, Sharon announced his intention to, quote, make separation across the land. Though initially resistant to the idea, he resolved to fulfill a plan first introduced in the 1990s under Yitzhak Rabin, the construction of a vast wall that would drive a nail into the coffin of the Palestinian National Movement. Cutting into the West Bank and Jordan Valley, the wall would effectively annex 80% of the settlements into Israel proper, consolidating the country's Jewish demographic majority while relegating Palestinians to a permanent regime of ghettoized exclusion. Let me point out, this has also, that description of ghettoized exclusion is also referred to more famously as the Bantustanization of Palestine, of the West Bank, a series of disconnected or semi-connected Bantustans peopled by the non-Jewish Palestinians of what remains of Palestine. Continuing. Next, Sharon planned to pull Israeli settlers from the Gaza Strip, setting the stage for a high-tech siege of that occupied coastal territory. Unlike in the past, Sharon sold his plans to the public with carefully calibrated, subtle, rhetorical touches. Stunned by a new movement of mass refusal, a group of former and active Israeli Air Force pilots had issued a letter declaring their refusal to participate in operations in occupied territory and by the furious opposition of the settlement movement to his plan, Sharon uncharacteristically proclaimed that the occupation was a, quote, bad thing for Israel. Next, he bolted from Likud, from the Likud party, cobbling together a random assortment of politicians, including his former aide, the telegenic, public relations-friendly Tzipi Livni, to drive the separation plan forward under the banner of Kadima, another Israeli political party, Kadima. Sharon's maneuvers earned him the political space he needed to fulfill his goals. Haaretz, the voice of Israeli liberalism, supported the vast separation wall as a, quote, revolutionary step towards two states. Endorsing the withdrawal of settlers from Gaza, the New York Times editorial board declared that Sharon, quote, should be cheered. It's the New York Times, their editorial board. Back in Tel Aviv, the anti-settlement group Peace Now and the Labor Party organized a mass demonstration in support of the Gaza disengagement plan, winning liberals to his side with Sharon's final political coup and probably his most consequential. The true goal of Sharon's separation regime was never to end the occupation, but to reinforce it under new parameters that would prevent the collapse of Israel's international image. A top aide to Sharon, Dov Weinglass, revealed the real logic behind Sharon's plans. I quote here, "The disengagement from Gaza is actually formaldehyde. It supplies the amount of formaldehyde that is necessary so there will not be a political process with the Palestinians," end quote. Another close advisor, Arnon Sofer, was even more frank. And what I'm about to read you is a quotation from Mr. Blumenthal's book, Goliath, that I've been reading to you. I read this in one of the last two shows. Another close advisor, Arnon Sofer, was even more frank. Here's the quote. "When 2.5 million people live in a closed-off Gaza, it's going to be a human catastrophe. Those people will become even bigger animals than they are today, with the aid of an insane fundamentalist Islam. The pressure at the border will be awful. It's going to be a terrible war. So, if we want to remain alive, we will have to kill and kill and kill all day, every day." End of quotation. Quotation from Arnon Sofer, the Arab counter, so-called Arab counter. 8 years after Sharon slipped into a coma, the real implications of separation stand exposed. Gaza suffers under a joint Israeli-Egyptian siege, while Israel shrugs off any responsibility for its inhabitants. Though Israel controls the entrances, exits, airspace, and coast of Gaza, and effectively regulates the caloric intake of each resident of the coastal territory, the occupation is over as far as its government is concerned. Israeli settlements are firmly entrenched in the West Bank and encircle East Jerusalem, reducing Palestinian areas to the pastrami sandwich of non-contiguous Bantustans that Sharon had originally envisioned. With the peace process effectively embalmed in political formaldehyde, right-wing elements have achieved unfettered dominance over the Jewish state's key institutions. Typical of the new generation of Israeli rightists is Sharon's corruption-stained son, Gilad, who has called Palestinian society a predator, an animal, and stabbers of babies. Now that Sharon's unilateral vision appears to have been consolidated, Israel's government must perpetually manage an occupation it has no intention of ending. It has no clear strategy to achieve international legitimacy and no endgame. Its direct line to Washington has become a life support system for the status quo. Like Sharon, who spent his last years in a comatose state without any hope of regaining consciousness, Israel is only buying time. End of article, which appears on thenation.com website. How Ariel Sharon Shaped Israel's Destiny, by Max Blumenthal. Okay, it's just about a quarter to 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time here on the west coast of North America. And you are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.3 FM. Or as my friend Donna insists on saying, 101.3 on the FM spectrum. Not a terribly strong signal, but we do pretty much reach everyone within the boundaries of the city of Santa Cruz here in Santa Cruz County, California. So, if you're listening to us either at 101.3 FM, or if you're listening to us on your computer at freakradio.org, tell all your friends, first of all, if they are tuning into our online radio service, make sure they click on the red oval so they can hook up successfully to our live streaming service, Free Radio Santa Cruz's live stream. And remind them that we are, after a hiatus of some 5.5 months, back on the traditional airwaves through old-fashioned fiddling of your radio dial, 101.3 FM. Hey. See, the thing is, there's one more here somewhere about... Whoops, oh, that's classic. I don't want that one. About Ariel Sharon. I thought I'd take advantage of this and just go ahead and read all three. I don't know if I could find it quickly enough. I seem to have misplaced that piece of paper, as it were. Okay. I think I found it. This one is from a colleague of mine, David Halpin, who resides in the United Kingdom. He's very good with words. He titles his message, Sharon... Ariel, Lion of G under -D, Lion of God, as it were, correspondence on media lens so far. And we're opening up the document now. Let me grab some cool drink. Nothing like a delicious cool beverage. Yeah, I'm going to read this one to you, too. Now, this is a Word document of some kind. Must read from Jonathan Cook, The Legacy of Ariel the Bulldozer Sharon. Posted by John Hilly on January 12th. That would have been yesterday, Sunday. From Jonathan Cook, The Legacy of Ariel the Bulldozer Sharon. Dear journalists, I have shut my ears to the MSM, fearing that this man will be smothered off and eventually canonized in a Judaic equivalent. But in one ear I earlier had the oily broadcasting house. In one ear, I earlier had the oily broadcasting house. Jeremy Bowen gave space to Sabra and Shatila, but not to Quibia, Jenin, Gaza, and all the rest of the killing, torture, and cleansing when he had power over the fourth largest army in the world. The Palestinian witness was not well recorded, but retribution seemed to be the theme. The semi-eulogies end with his, quote, withdrawal from Gaza, rather than the consolidation of his forces and yet further division of the native people. An impression is given that his, quote, facts on the ground, he had directly encouraged the vicious emplacements in the ineptly named West Bank were regretted by him in the mellowness of his years. A Disgusting Gift, a Slow Fuse by Cunning Albion. I'm not sure what all this guy is referring to, but as I indicated when I started reading this, the salutation is Dear Journalists. So let's continue and see, get a better idea of who he's talking to and why. Mellowness, the milk of human kindness, had no place in his considerable corpus. He was a psychopath, but not of the paramount proportions of Blair. I suspect he's talking about Tony Blair, former Prime Minister of Great Britain. The British Broadcasting Corporation, the BBC, has done its best to rehabilitate the latter, Blair. It might be starting on the former. Look to the upbringing when you detect the psychopath. We learn his father gave him a dagger at age 5. This, the following cited... Pardon me, please. The following sentences are cited from Wikipedia. At age 10, Sharon entered the Zionist youth movement Hasadeh. As a young teenager, he first began to take part in the armed night patrols of his moshav. In 1942, at the age of 14, Sharon joined the Gadna, a paramilitary youth battalion, and later the Haganah, the underground paramilitary force and the Jewish military precursor to the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF. Did the armed night patrols have some connection with the murderous special night squads of the psychopath Orde Wingate? How many British Mandate civilians, police, and soldiers did Sharon help liberate from their lives? The context of his life and the loss of many others has been told well by Jonathan Cook yesterday in The Legacy of Ariel the Bulldozer. But I would go further. The Legacy of Ariel, one of many war criminals. Every time the MSM smooths off one of the many unindicted war criminals, the more they and their crimes thrive, whilst millions upon millions suffer. For Truth, Reason, and Justice, David Halpin, MBBS, FRCS. Block carbon copy to my colleague, Sui Yang, who is a witness in Beirut. Is the BBC to interview her? And a few short snippets from various sources regarding the untimely death of Ariel Sharon after 8-year coma by David Masselwain. Well said, David. And to see this psychopathic violence encouraged so early, now referred to in terms like decisive or controversial rather than murderous or inhumane, is disgusting. All you can say is that the man is dead. Something that can't be said for Tony Blair, who is alive and head-kicking, and apparently is meeting with Pope Francis tomorrow, presumably to try to knock any sense out of his head on Syria. Thanks, David, for bringing up the psychopathic aspect of Sharon. I have some doubts about Cook's article. You must... posted by R. Shihayan. You must be a psychopath if you can torture millions and murder thousands. To be honest, I didn't like Jonathan Cook's article. The phrase war crime or criminal is not used in the article, and notice how the word massacre is used the following carefully written paragraph, and he quotes the paragraph here. Along the way, and in the spirit of Unit 101, his commanders oversaw the horrific massacre of hundreds, and more likely thousands, of Palestinian refugees in the Sabra and Shatila camps by Israel's phalangist allies. A reminder, Israel's Christian phalangist allies, an event for which an Israeli inquiry found him personally responsible. Why not say, quote, he was personally responsible for many war crimes, among them the horrific massacre, .. end quote. And here's another posting by author David Halpin. Events, Adventures, War of Independence for the Zionist Entity and Destruction of Palestine. Those are separate quotable quotes, such as events, such as Adventures or War of Independence. Thank you, David McKee and R. Cheyenne. Points taken. When I heard the destruction of Iraq and many of its people described by the smoothers as an adventure, I wish their fascist chums in the SIS and defense forces would descend on them, render them, and have them rewrite their evil copy in custody. They are complicit in the shredding of international law and in a multitude of crimes which could not be imagined after that war to end wars Cameron and pals are celebrating. Cameron, he would be referring to David Cameron, the current Prime Minister of Great Britain. Incidentally, the email was sent to Messrs. Bowen, Adams, Reynolds, Starton, bounced to Starton, Ware Davies, Broadcasting House, and that temple of the mealy mouth and collaborator in unlawful war, Lambeth Palace. The latter will thank me for writing. The former secretary there, Livesey, had previously been with Blair in Number 10. YCNMIU. Some text acronym, no doubt. YCNMIU. I won't begin to take up any more time trying to decipher that. Just for those of you who are text acronym savvy. Finally, I omitted for space the fact that Wingate taught torture and murder to keen Zionists in his British Mandate-sponsored special night squads. And by the way, John Neusinger, The Blood Never Dried, that is, on the British Empire. Taken from John Neusinger's The Blood Never Dried, that is, on the British Empire. The rule for all should be, no mother and child should be in the least harmed anywhere in our still beautiful world. David S. Halpin. I have a certain reverence for Dave Halpin simply because I met him only once on the island of Cyprus as I and my 43 other sea-bound activists were preparing to sail into the port of Gaza City in August of 2008. That trip was successful, and our two completely refurbished, as much as we could afford to refurbish them, former fishing vessels as we were getting ready to board those two vessels for the more than 24 hour plus voyage into the Gaza Strip, David Halpin joined us in one of our preparatory classes and helped us put the whole thing into perspective, helped us to understand he was visiting from Great Britain and contributing to the effort that way. I don't know what all else the man does, what or who he writes for, but he obviously is a very extensive writer and knows a lot of writers. He referred to me as a writer, and even before I appreciated the scope of this man's work, I was touched and gratified by David calling me a writer. He helped us put things into perspective. And in the last 5 years, of course, since that voyage, I've only been on the receiving end of some of his communications. And I do apologize once again for the smattering of references to MSM and this and that. Of course, I skipped over many links, internet links here, as they would be meaningless on radio. But I just wanted to get into that and see what that was all about. Okay, that is over. Okay. It is now a minute past 4 o'clock, 1,600 hours plus 1 Pacific Standard Time here in Santa Cruz County, California. This is Mideast Migraines, brought to you via Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.3 FM. And, of course, as an internet radio service at freakradio.org. That's freak, F-R-E-A-K, radio.org, freakradio.org. Tell all your friends to click on that. Hey, big red oval. When you scroll down the main page of our website, freakradio.org, for the streaming link, if they want to listen to us on their little pewters. Musical break.
كيفاش خيرتي انا سي وش هو عملي واللي نعيد له يستغرب فيما صار بي
كيفاش خيرتي انا سي وش هو عملي واللي نعيد له يستغرب فيما صار بي
خليك يا نايم وعلاش تلومني في حالي لطفك لي عط غرامي تبكي على بكايا
كيفاش خيرتي انا سي وش هو
نغرم حبت تشوفي مكداد في دخالي الصهد والجفا والهجرة تردف عليا سلطان الهوى عمدني وعزم على قتالي سلسيف ودعاني طعتو آست بيا سيوف ماضية ومزارق ومحاد حاطلي ميلي لنسلم وانطيع إذا عفا عليا
كيفاش حيرتي يا ناسي واش هو عملي واللي نعيد له يستغرب فيما صار بيا
سيف الغرم قسم قلبي والغير ما درالي لا طبيب فادني ولا طلبة دبروا عليا مشيت للفقيه نعيد له كل ما جرالي قال لي عشق الريم هذاك علاش جيت ليا
كيفاش حيرتي يا ناسي واش هو عملي واللي نعيد له يستغرب فيما صار بيا كيفاش حيرتي يا ناسي واش هو عملي واللي نعيد له يستغرب فيما صار بيا
خطية واللي ما ذهب الدنيا من الروح حالي مثل بهي يحرث ويجي العلف العشية واللي غنم سلوانه في الدنيا رزق وحلالي وإذا يتوب لله ربي غفار كرسية بالله يا أهلي عذروني وزعفوا هبالي لعشاق كي يسمعوني يرحموا عليا
واش هو عملي واللي نعيد له يستغرب فيما صار بيا كيفاش قلتي يا ناسي واش هو عملي واللي نعيد له يستغرب فيما صار بيا كيفاش قلتي يا ناسي واش هو عملي واللي نعيد له يستغرب فيما صار بيا كيفاش قلتي يا ناسي واش هو
قل لي وعلى
Hi. Okay, it's 10 after 4. This is Mideast Migraines. 10 after 4 p.m. on Monday, January 13. If that coincides with your own personal time-space continuum, 4:10, now 4:11 on Jan 13, then you know the show is live. So you can call in. Here's the phone number. Area code 831-427-3772. I'll say it again twice more in case you're forced to remember it. Area 831-427-3772. 831-427-3772. And just to ingrain it that much more, 427-3772, live to the studio here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. Phones are open and hung up, so your call will go through. Oh, this is very interesting. Now, I've talked quite a bit about BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement against Cultural and Academic Institutions of Israel. I'm freaking out. I hear hearing someone screaming outside the studio. It's more likely something being transmitted over somebody else's radio signal. Or it could just be a record or disc or something. I'll try not to be rankled by it. So, I've talked about boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. Let's take a look at one of the overseas... one of the overseas aspects of this boycott campaign specifically. And this is from the Washington Post, yesterday's Washington Post. Jordan Valley settlements hit by boycott campaign. Referring, of course, to illegal, exclusively Jewish Israeli settlements in the illegally occupied West Bank of Historic Palestine. Comes to us by way of the Associated Press. January 10, actually, which would have been last Friday. Netiv Hagdud, West Bank. An international campaign to boycott Israeli settlement products has rapidly turned from a distance nuisance into a harsh economic reality for Israeli farmers in the West Bank's Jordan Valley. The export-driven income of growers in the valley's 21 settlements dropped by more than 14%, or $29 million, last year, largely because Western European supermarket chains, particularly those in Britain and Scandinavia, are increasingly shunning the area's peppers, dates, grapes, and fresh herbs, say the settlers. The damage is enormous, said David Elhayani, head of the Jordan Valley Regional Council, which represents about 7,000 settlers. In effect, today, we are almost not selling to the Western European market anymore. Israel has played down the impact of the campaign of boycott, divestment, and sanctions launched by Palestinian activists, including, I, Ren, will add, those activists include non-Palestinians who are in solidarity with the Palestinians, in 2005 to pressure Israel to withdraw from occupied lands. By and large, it's unpleasant background noise, said Israeli Foreign Ministry spokesman Yigal Palmor, arguing that its overall effects have been negligible. However, the lament of the Jordan Valley farmers comes against the backdrop of a growing debate in Israel about the aftermath of a possible failure of U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry's latest mediating mission. Kerry wants to forge agreement on the outlines of an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal despite major disagreements between the sides. Israeli supporters of a land for peace deal with the Palestinians have warned that Israel could face a snowballing boycott of the magnitude that brought down apartheid in South Africa if it rebuffs proposals John Kerry is to present in coming weeks. Finance Minister Yair Lapid, speaking to the news website Ynet, warned Israelis on Friday that, and I quote, "a continuation of the existing situation will hurt the pocketbook of each of us," end quote, particularly by hitting exports. The Palestinians, too, could face repercussions if the talks collapse, such as less foreign aid from Europe. The fate of the Jordan Valley has featured prominently in Kerry's meetings with Israeli and Palestinian leaders. The Palestinians want a state in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem, lands Israel captured in 1967. Some 47 years ago, and the valley would form Palestine's eastern border with Jordan. Kerry reportedly proposed that Israel maintain military control of that border for at least 10 years after a peace deal to address Israeli concerns about a surprise Arab attack or the possible influx of weapons and militants. Israeli security hawks say the valley must remain under Israeli control forever. The Palestinians argue that this would prevent them from establishing a viable state because they need the farmlands and open spaces. Uzi Dayan, a former Israeli national security advisor, said Israel needs the valley, which makes up close to one-fourth of the West Bank, for strategic depth. "Being here in the Jordan Valley, it is something existential," he said this week. Uzi Dayan, standing on a mountaintop overlooking sprawling date-palmed plantations. "The national security of Israel is based on defensible borders, not on boycotts." But economic worries are growing for some of the valley's farmers. Neva Benzion, who lives in the Nativ Hagdud settlement, used to sell 80% of her sweet peppers and grapes to supermarket chains in Western Europe, particularly in Britain. "Sales to Western Europe plummeted in the last 2 years," she said, adding that she now sells mostly to Eastern Europe and Russia for up to 40% less. She reduced her growing area by one-third this season and doubts she can make ends meet in the future. Zvi Avner, head of the Agricultural Committee in the Jordan Valley, confirmed that sales of peppers and grapes to Western Europe, mainly Britain and Scandinavia, have dropped by about 50% and fresh herbs by about 30 to 40%. Avner and Elhayani said they are confident they can overcome the difficulties by selling in new markets and by farming more effectively. The European Union says Israel's settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, now home to more than 550,000 Israelis, are illegal under international law, but has not called, the European Union has not called for a consumer boycott of settlement products. As part of the U.S.-led peace talks, the EU, European Union, has promised Israel and the Palestinians an unprecedented partnership, just short of full membership if they strike a deal. However, if talks fail, the Palestinians might expect a cutback in EU aid, while Israel might have to brace for a tougher anti-settlement stance by Europe. This might include reviving plans for EU-wide guidelines for labeling settlement products. Currently, about half the 28 member states of the EU support such labeling, a step that would enable consumers to observe a boycott. Britain issued guidelines to retailers for the voluntary labeling of settlement products in 2009. In December, Britain's overseas trade body strongly discouraged firms from doing business with settlements. That was last month. In recent years, several British supermarket chains have either begun labeling or stopped selling goods from Israeli settlements. Supermarkets are now starting to realize that there's a really big reputational risk involved here, said Michael Dees, a Britain-based coordinator for the international boycott movement. Marks and Spencer said it hadn't sold any products from the West Bank since 2007. Some 7 years ago. Upscale supermarket chain Waitrose said it stopped selling herbs from the West Bank several years ago. Morrison's, Britain's fourth largest grocer, said it stopped selling dates from the West Bank in 2011. Dates. In 2012, the Cooperative Group, the country's fifth largest grocer, banned Israeli settlement produce from its shelves. Just 2 years ago, Cooperative Group country's fifth largest grocer, banned all Israeli settlement produce from its shelves. Some retailers, like Co-op, said they were taking a moral stand, decrying the settlements as illegal. Others, like Waitrose, said their decision was commercial. In Germany, the Kaiser's supermarket chain said it stopped carrying products from the West Bank and the Israeli annexed Golan Heights in 2012. Israeli officials say the boycott has strong anti-Semitic overtones and aims to delegitimize the Jewish state. Supporters of the campaign say they are gaining momentum and have pointed to a string of recent successes. This week, Dutch pension asset manager PGGM said it divested from five Israeli banks because they are involved in financing the construction of Jewish settlements. Other moves, such as a recent decision by an American scholarly group to boycott Israeli universities, invited a broad backlash, in part because it targeted Israel and not just settlements. I believe this American scholarly group they're referring to is the ASA, American Studies Association. Jordan Valley settlers say a boycott also hurts about 6,000 Palestinians employed on their farms, employed on Israeli settler Jordan Valley farms. Palestinian officials counter that Israel has suppressed virtually all Palestinian economic development in the valley and that Palestinians could create tens of thousands of jobs if freed from Israeli shackles. While some settlers hope to see the valley annexed to Israel, Benzion, 57, said she wouldn't stand in the way of peace, even if it means dismantling her life's work. Nothing breaks my heart so easy, especially not bricks, she said. I will not even have a second thought of leaving here if it's for a peace treaty with our neighbors. I will cherish that. I must say I am moved by that statement from an Israeli, by a settler in particular. But talk, as they say, is cheap. At least one must assume that when they first hear talked. Associated Press writers Raphael Satter in London and Kirsten Grieshaber in Berlin contributed to this report. Copyright 2014, the Associated Press. I just want to zero in on that one sentence toward the end. Or Israeli officials say the boycott has strong anti-Semitic overtones and aims to delegitimize the Jewish state. I have a couple of things to say about that sentiment. Blaming anti-Semitism. Always narrowing the focus of their response to the criticism they receive from the world to simply a matter of anti-Semitism, which is a fancy term for people who hate Jews because they're Jews, is the longest standing tactic in the whole and all of Zionist activity for the last 150 years or so. Of course, when the political philosophy of Zionism began to come to fruition in the second half of the 19th century, the 1800s, the whole idea was to find a place, a national homeland, a real piece of real estate, where Jews, hopefully all Jews from everywhere in the world, could come and live in isolation, at least national isolation, from all other people who are not Jewish, whatever their religion or their inclination, spiritual inclination or lack of it. The whole idea of this Zionism was to protect Jews from those who would hate them and hurt them. They certainly had a long, tumultuous history spanning, well, over a couple of thousand years since they've been around for 2.5 to 3 millennia, the Jewish people, relating to their ancient Hebraic roots. Many people, they've had enemies from many quarters, not to get into whose fault it was that they were made enemies, but this is in fact the history of the world. One group setting itself apart from and then against another group, often in a fascistic or self-over-promoting an internal preference over the other people, saying God is with us only, or we are stronger, we are better, we are more moral, we are more advanced, we're more civil. But the point is, the Jews having this very, very long history, first in the Eastern world, in the so-called Orient, although it was more like the threshold of land between East and West, between the Orient and the Western world, and then in the New World of the Americas, there is a terrible, terrible history of anti-Semitism, of those who choose to hate Jews for their own Judaicness. And this came to be known as anti-Semitism, which is really a very peculiar usage of the term Semitism or Semitic. Semitic refers actually to the languages spoken by the peoples of the Middle East. I imagine the Hebrew language would be the earliest Semitic language. I'm not sure of the word history, the history of the word itself, but Hebrew, of course, is a Semitic language. Arabic, which came later, of the same derivation as Hebrew, essentially, is also a Semitic language. Aramaic, which was the language Jesus and his people spoke in the time of Jesus, is Semitic. Aramaic, by the way, is still spoken by thousands of people to this day. It is considered a dying language, but I believe that recent efforts have been made to, what am I trying to say? To resurrect the Aramaic language. I believe that Aramaic does not have its own written form, but I may be wrong. They most likely utilize Arabic script with Aramaic words spelt out in the letters of the Arabic alphabet. That's my guess. So, getting back to the sentence that I'm targeting here, Israeli officials say the boycott has strong anti-Semitic overtones and aims to delegitimize the Jewish state. In spite of the apparent noble intentions of the Zionist movement, once again, as so many movements before it, it has been proven you cannot simply resurrect an ancient, or in the name of an ancient peoples, resurrect it in the middle of a hunk of land without affecting someone else. As it turns out, Palestine was by no means an empty land, or as these early Israelis like to say, a land without people for a people without a land, referring to themselves. They wanted to find what they expressed to the world was an essentially abandoned strip of real estate on the far end of the eastern end of the Mediterranean Sea, so the Jews could take it for themselves and have their state. Palestinian Arabs were there. Other groups were there. There were even a tiny minority of Jews who never left their ancient roots. Again, you're going to have this kind of thing any given place around the world. An ancient people whose bloodlines have survived to the present day in one form or another. You cannot just resurrect a new land without stepping on someone else's toes. And of course, this someone else has been played down very effectively, championingly so, by the Israelis, as they have vilified, demonized, and crushed the national aspirations of the Palestinian Arabs who live in historic Palestine, which includes, of course, modern Israel. So many in Israel will funnel everything down, every last argument against them and against what they're doing, against their policies, against what their military is doing to native Arabs, funnel and screen all of those criticisms down to its pure anti-Semitism. They'll say it's only anti-Semitic. They hate Jews just like everyone else has, from the Russian pogroms to Eastern European pogroms to the Holocaust of World War II, what Germany did to them, what the Italians did in some cases to the Jews, what Americans did to certain Jews during and before the war years and since. They're going to stress and overstress and nothing but stress the fact that this is merely anti-Semitism. All I say is don't be fooled by that. There's a lot of very terrible things that the whole thing about Israel is doing against the native Palestinians of that land. As far as delegitimizing the Jewish state is concerned, many will say, I don't argue with that at all. I mean, some will say Israel is a bastard state, which came about as an imposition, a colonial imposition from without, and that is historically true. This tiny minority of Palestinian Jews who have lived and thrived, actually, in Palestine for well over two millennia, well over 2,000 years, cannot be made into an excuse for expelling the great, great, great majority of Christian and Muslim Palestinians who live there too. No excuse can be made for killing them or expelling them, turning them into refugees, and forcing them to stay outside of Israel with their walls and fences and gates and military posts and Jewish-only roads and Jewish-only settlements that keep sprouting up all over Palestine, the West Bank. Gaza no longer has Jewish settlements per se, but they are living in an economic siege. It is, by several measurements, the world's largest open-air prison. People can very, very rarely get in, particularly non-Jews. Palestinian Arabs can rarely get into Gaza for any length of time, and it's even difficult for some of them to get out, or if they are able to get out, they can't get back in, because Israel would love for the Palestinian Arabs to continue to vacate the Gaza Strip, even though the Gaza Strip is governed by an independent political group, namely Hamas, who cannot govern properly because they do not have access to the through the gates of their own land. Okay, I'm just getting into pure tirade here now, if I haven't been for some minutes. So, many see this as a perfectly fine thing to base the delegitimization of the Jewish state on, for they're not acting properly as a state of their own and not treating their native people properly. So for some, delegitimization of the Jewish state, hey, I admit that pure and simple. That's not a crime. Look at how they're acting. They're delegitimizing the Palestinian natives. They don't even like that. Israelis don't even like to use the word Palestinians or Palestine. They, by and large, do not use those words in the classrooms or in the textbooks, from what I understand, of their children. And through their still many media outlets in Israel refuse to use those two words, Palestine or Palestinian, in their dispatches, articles, etc. Okay. Now, still on the subject of BDS. I just received this yesterday. This is from the United States Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. Note, the organization is not called the U.S. Campaign to End Israel. It is not called the U.S. Campaign to delegitimize into non-existence the state of Israel. It is the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, specifically of the West Bank, Gaza, and its siege of Gaza and East Jerusalem. That is the purpose, stated purpose, and the history of that organization. The USC EIO is U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation by Rama Kudaimi, membership and outreach coordinator for that organization, January 10. He is talking about an online briefing. Join online briefing on Israel state bonds and divestment efforts. I will read the article and then briefly mention something about how to hook up to that online briefing. In 1950, way back in 1950, Israeli leaders and a group of Americans met in Jerusalem to discuss ways of financing the new country of Israel. At that point, 2 years old. The group came up with the idea to sell bonds. They called their company the Development Corporation for Israel and began a campaign to sell Israel bonds in the United States. Today, more than 80 state and municipal governments, including Florida, Louisiana, Indiana, Arizona, South Carolina, Maryland, and New York City, have invested at least $2 billion in Israel bonds. In March of last year, 2013, Ohio bought $42 million in Israel bonds, reportedly the largest single government purchase of Israel bonds in U.S. history. Israel bonds help finance the Israeli government's budget, thereby aiding Israel's ongoing colonization of Palestinian land and entrenching its apartheid policies and military occupation. Entrenching it. It's apartheid and its occupation. In other words, when municipalities and states buy Israel bonds, residents of those cities and states are made directly complicit in financing Israel's oppression of Palestinians. Want to learn more about Israel Bonds and how to organize a divestment campaign? Join a national online briefing on Thursday, January 16. That's this week in 3 days. Thursday the 16th at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. That would be 5:30 here on the west coast of California. Yeah, 8:30 p.m. Eastern, 5:30 p.m. PST, Pacific Standard Time, with member group Minnesota Break the Bonds. I lived in Minnesota for 35 years myself, so I naturally was excited to see this little logo in the article. Since 2006, the Minnesota Break the Bonds campaign, MinBBC, Break the Bonds campaign, has been organizing to end their state's investment in Israel bonds worth around $18 million. After public letter-writing campaigns to state lawmakers and meetings with representatives from the State Board of Investment, the SBI, did not lead to divestment in November 2011. MinBBC, along with 26 other co-plaintiffs, including Palestinian residents of Bilin in the West Bank and members of the Israeli group Boycott From Within, served a lawsuit against the SBI, that's the SBI, State Board of Investment, demanding that it cancel its Israel bonds investments. The lawsuit was dismissed in November 2012. The Minnesota Court of Appeals failed to reverse that decision. The campaign continues, and last September, members of MinBBC personally delivered a comprehensive report to Governor Mark Dayton at the quarterly SBI meeting documenting the SBI's 20-year failure to follow its own international human rights investment guidelines. As more states and municipalities invest in Israel, join this national briefing to learn about the history of the campaign, the different mechanisms the group is pursuing, including media, legislative, educational, and regulatory and judicial efforts, and tips about how you can start your own campaign. Folks, if this tickles your shackles at all, your shackles or your hackles, just go to the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, to avail yourself the opportunity to connect to these links for how to prepare for this briefing this Thursday at 5:30 California time, 5:30 p.m. of course. I believe they're providing some kind of a packet or something for you to maybe, I thought I read something about some information. Go to U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation for pertinent information and the proper links that will allow you to join the briefing. If nothing more, it may satisfy your curiosity. I'm sure all the bad people who are listening and monitoring to this Mideast Migraines program, formerly called Mideast Madness on Free Radio Santa Cruz, are listening intently. There are always a minimum of three computer-identified entities who listen to my show. And for the life of I know what one of them is, but the other two are probably, they could very well be, the pro-Israel people who are monitoring this show in case I get, out of hand. Start to ramble on like I am right now. It's 4:45. Still not a peep from my skillions and thousands of listeners out there. You can call me at area code 831-427-3772. Okay, a couple of program-related announcements and then the more general announcements. Whether you call me on the telly right now or not, on the phony right now or not, you can still leave a message with me. Simply write to MideastMadness@gmx.com. That, the name of that email service for this radio program, includes the original title of this program, Mideast Madness. Again, it is MideastMadness@gmx.com. G as in gigantic. Second letter, M as in malignant. X as in xylophone.com. MideastMadness@gmx.com. gmx.com. Also, to remind you, as I do twice a week, at least once per show, the archives containing most of my shows, the recordings for most of my shows, now called Mideast Migraines, is available at radioforall.net. That's the word radio, the numerical character 4, ALL.NET, radioforall.net. Just type in Mideast Madness or Mideast Migraines, depending on the recentness of the program you may be interested in, and take it from there. Now, the more general announcements. I wish that I had more opportunities to remind everyone of the fact that not only is Free Radio Santa Cruz soon to enter its 19th year of public service as an FCC non-compliant underground pirate radio service, having been liberating the airwaves since 1995, as we like to remind everyone, is back on the airwaves. In the beginning of July of last year, we were forced to discontinue, in fact, to physically dismantle our transmitter from the plot of land where it lie, stoically and working most of the time for many years. And then the banks came in and the word foreclosure entered the picture. Not of our radio service as such, not the station nor the transmitter itself, but of the land as it was owned by someone. It fell into foreclosure, and we realized we were going to have to preserve our hardware, disconnect the antenna, take her down, diserect it, and put her in someone's garage until we found another appropriate location for it. Well, we have found such a location. That is the upside, and it is completely erected, powered up, and just chiming away 24 hours, 7 days a week, 365 and one-fourth days per year, roughly. So barring unforeseen circumstances, we are broadcasting on the airwaves at 101.3 FM again for the city of Santa Cruz, as well as continuing our internet radio service at freakradio.org. Scroll down the main page and click on the red oval. There's a cute little red oval, very bright red oval, atop the pictured radio transmitter on that website's front page. Thing is, the story on the transmitter, the downside to this is it is by no means a permanent location. Of course, being business savvy as we are in the pirate radio business, we must treat any current location for a physical transmitter as an interim site, as a temporary site, not knowing what may happen the next day or even later that same day. We're still looking for a site which will likewise be underlyingly treated as a temporary site, but which may promise more permanence for us. Let me put it this way. We are not happy with the particular hunk of real estate where our transmitter sits. It works for us. It gets the air, it gets the radio waves out there. It's at a decent elevation above the city, but it is simply not where we would prefer to have one right now. We do not feel, and for good reason, we don't feel highly secure about the future of this particular site. So we're still looking, and we're still asking people to think about where we might move it to, most likely not very far in terms of miles or even hundreds of yards from where it is now, because it is at a place of geographic and sort of geological preference. It's got to be high, which is to say, obviously, in the western part of the city of Santa Cruz, where the elevation is very high. Locals know this area as the Poganip, or in the vicinity of the Poganip. Perhaps the north-central part of the city of Santa Cruz, or the De La Viega Park area, would work well, too. There are certain areas, such as downtown Santa Cruz, where it simply won't work at all. That sits in a trough, and even reception of our radio signal is poor in most places downtown, or in some places downtown. So give this some thought. Go to our website. Hook up with us in terms of contacting us. Like, I'm clicking on the word contact right now. You'll get our email address, frsc@freakradio.org. There's a voicemail line, which is on the website. Area code 831-427-4523. At least I assume that is still a good number. My apologies if you run across any information on the website which is defunct or no longer being the case, but that is what it is. Again, try 831-427-4523 to leave a voicemail. Please leave us your ideas, comments, complaints, and public service announcements. 427-4523. The number is on our website at freakradio.org. There's also the studio line that I've been giving you, 427-3772. Make requests, ask questions, and or announce breaking news events. And please keep in mind, we programmers are responsible for roughly 50% of the influx of money that keeps this radio service going, whether it's on the net or over the airwaves. Programmers have to pay on a monthly basis. Some of us are better at doing that than others. And characteristically, in the highest responsible tradition, free radio, more often than not, will dismiss, sometimes in great numbers of people, will dismiss from this service the programs and those programmers who fail to support their program with their own money. And hence that accounts for a lot of program changes here at Pirate Radio in Santa Cruz. So the other roughly 50% comes from you. Please consider sending your donations to Free Radio Santa Cruz, or just write FRSC on the envelope. Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California 95061. Again, send your donations, as much or as little as you can afford, as often as you can, to FRSC, P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California 95061. There's even an application in English or in Spanish, in Espanol, if you are interested in doing your own radio show. Go to our site for those details. Okay, folks, I thank you once again for listening to Mideast Migraines. This is Ren Tawil signing off until next Saturday, actually, when I do the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines at 11 a.m. And that, of course, includes and is comprised almost entirely by the reading of M. Blumenthal's Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. 11 a.m. Saturday, and of course, I'll talk at you next Monday at 3 p.m. Ta-ta.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, January 13th, 2014. In the West Bank, the Israeli army attacked anti-settlements protesters. Meanwhile, the Navy attacked fishing boats near Gaza City. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A number of non-violent Palestinian activists closed on Monday the entrance of El Azar illegal Israeli settlement, one of the settlements of Gosh Atzion settlement block in Bethlehem district, southern West Bank. Activists said that soldiers attacked and kidnapped several protesters and that this activity comes to affirm the Palestinian rejection to Israel's illegal settlements in occupied Palestine. Moreover, Israeli soldiers kidnapped three nonviolent activists as they were heading to Palestinian lands near the settlement to plant olive trees, local sources reported. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers invaded various areas in southern West Bank district of Hebron and kidnapped five Palestinians. Three more Palestinians were kidnapped in Bethlehem and two Palestinian children in Jerusalem. Local sources have reported that the army invaded the old part of Hebron and the nearby towns of Dura and Sa'ir.